Matthew chapter 27, picking up at verse 11 in our study, we're looking at the trial of Jesus. He has already been before the Sanhedrin Council. Matthew, of course, interrupts the trial between the Sanhedrin Council and him being taken to Pilate with his remarks about Judas in verse 3 of chapter 27 through verse 10. And we're picking up at verse 11, where he's before Pontius Pilate now, as Matthew records it. Remember, when he comes to Pontius Pilate, not long into his conversation with Pilate, John tells us that Pilate, having learned that he came from Galilee, actually sent him to Herod. And so Herod spoke with him as well, and then Herod sent him back to Pontius Pilate. But of course, Matthew does not record that section in his gospel account. We're in Matthew 27, picking up in verse 11, and I'm reading from the New King James Version. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" So Jesus said to him, "It is as you say. Are you the king of the Jews?" Now remember, we had mentioned in our last meeting that the Sanhedrin Council had to come up with some crime to charge Jesus with, by which Pontius would want to put him to death for. Now remember, when Jesus was before the Sanhedrin Council, he had claimed to be the Christ, the Son of God. He had claimed to be deity in the flesh. So they charged him with blasphemy, a man making himself God. And according to the law of Moses, of course, he could have been stoned to death. But of course, Pilate would not have put him to death simply because he claimed to be God in the flesh. So the Sanhedrin Council had to come up with some accusation, some charge against him that would cause Pilate to want to put him to death. And so we see here, and we could read also Luke's account and Mark's account, but particularly Luke's account, we could see that evidently they had made charges against Jesus that, well, he says he's a king. Since he said he was the Messiah, the Christ, he was a king, but he also claimed to be deity in the flesh. But to Pilate, being deity in the flesh didn't mean nothing. But if he was going to claim to be king, then that would mean something to him, especially if Pilate wanted to keep Tiberius Caesar happy and not have someone rise up and seek to take the throne from him. So that seems to be the charge already, as Pilate asked him on this occasion, "Are you the king of the Jews?" That's why he would have asked that question. "Are you the king of the Jews?" So Jesus said to him, "It is as you say." Now, that's an affirmative to the question that was asked. Jesus affirms the fact that he is the king of the Jews. And while he was being accused by the chief priest and elders, he answered nothing. While he was being accused, while he was being charged, they're rendering certain charges against him, and so Jesus says nothing in regard to his defense. But note some of the things that they evidently said about him and some of the accusations and charges they made. You can turn over to Luke chapter 23 and we see some of the accusations and charges evidently that they were bringing against him that would perhaps cause the governor to render a death penalty for him. In Luke 23, beginning in verse 1, "Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying," that is, render certain charges against him, "We found this fellow perverting the nation," note this, "forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." So they've charged him with, I guess, tax evasion and claiming to be a king himself. So if Pilate is going to remain faithful and true to Tiberius Caesar, the Roman emperor who put him in charge of Judea, then Pilate wouldn't want somebody to rise up claiming to be a king. Back in our text in Matthew chapter 27 and verse 12 then, and while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, that is those members of the Sanhedrin council that was presenting the case before Pilate, Jesus answered nothing. And verse 13 of Matthew 27, then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear," note this, "how many things they testify against you?" So we don't know all the things that they testified against him, all the charges and accusations they made against him. But evidently it was, they just kept piling them on to, so Pilate would have no way to be able to release him. He would want to put him to death. But that was not the case. Not the case at all, as we're going to see. Verse 14 of Matthew 27. And he answered him not one word, so that the governor marveled greatly. He was astonished and amazed that here a man is brought before him, and Pilate has the power to take his life or release him. But yet he does not defend himself. Jesus does not answer one accusation or one charge that is made against him. Of course, he is intent on carrying out the will of God in dying for the sins of mankind. And there would have been no cause or no reason to answer the charges. Because how do you defend against something that they're lying about? They could come up with all the false witnesses they want. And so he would not be able to defend himself against all the lies to begin with. So he answers nothing. Verse 15 of Matthew 27. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. Now at the feast, note that. What feast is under consideration? Remember, it's the feast of Passover back in chapter 26. Back in chapter 26 and in verse 5. Chapter 26 and in verse 5, remember, pick up at verse 3 of Matthew 26. Then the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. But they said, not during the feast, lest there be an uproar among the people. Remember, they didn't want to do it during the feast. The feast of Passover, remember, that only lasted one day. Jesus instituted Lord's Supper on that day, on Thursday. But remember, there was a seven-day feast of unleavened bread to follow. So here the phrase, the feast, covers that Thursday, the day of Passover itself, plus the 7 days of unleavened bread. So that's how the word feast is used here in Matthew 27. Matthew 27 and verse 15. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release to the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. So at the feast of unleavened bread, at the feast of Passover, during that period of time, it was a custom for the governor to release usually a political prisoner. A political prisoner. And so, they're going to release somebody, liberate somebody who's been imprisoned, and Jesus is going to be put to death. Verse 16. And they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. A notorious prisoner. A very notable prisoner. One whom everyone knew about. Notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Now, he is referred to in the other gospel accounts, in three different ways. He's referred to as an insurrectionist, one who caused an uprising, one who rebelled against the authority of the emperor. He is also called a robber, and he's also called a murderer. So he's an insurrectionist, one who's caused an uprising against the government, against the authorities. He has murdered someone in the process of doing that, and he is a robber. Now, the word robber, remember, the Greeks had two different words for robbers or thieves. Remember, one robber or thief was like the apostle who just took his life, Judas. He was a thief, but he stole by stealth. He stole secretly. The other kind of robber or thief is the one who will hit you over the head or kill you to take what you have. That's Barabbas. That's the Greek word. Now, we also learn later on that there's two other robbers who are crucified with Jesus. Perhaps they were associates of Barabbas. And all three of them had been taken prisoner during the time of the insurrection. But Barabbas, being the leader of the group, and Notorious, is going to be set free. Verse 17 of Matthew 27. Therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?" Who is called Christ? Christ, the Anointed One, the Messiah. He claimed to be the Messiah. He claimed to be the Anointed One. He claimed to be the one whom the prophet spoke of, who was going to come and establish a kingdom, and it would last forever. And so, who do we release then? Who do you want me to liberate? Who do you want me to set free, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ? For he knew that because of envy they had delivered him. He knew that because of envy they had delivered him. That is, they had delivered him or turned him over to the authorities. Jesus was turned over to the authorities because of envy. Envy. Now, there's about four different Greek words in the New Testament translated envy. Sometimes it's translated from the same word, it's translated jealousy. And if we looked in the English dictionary, envy and jealousy might be seen as synonyms. But the word that is translated envy here is never used in a good sense in the Scripture. Never used in a good sense. Sometimes we use the word envy, not meaning anything bad by it. Someone might say, a young lady might see the ring on another young lady's finger, an engagement ring, and say, "Oh, I'm envious of you." And we might use it in an innocent way like that. But they had delivered up Jesus and turned him over to the authorities to be put to death out of envy. Envy is ill will that is directed toward another because of either a real or supposed something good that has happened to them. I often use politicians as those who like to create envy between the rich and the poor. Every time of election time, some politicians will create envy in the hearts of some so that they'll not vote for a certain one. And because some people see if the politician can drum up enough envy in their heart or can make it to be manifest and brought out, then they'll express that ill will toward the rich man. But the rich man hadn't done anything to them. But nonetheless, because of envy, they have ill will toward him. And they want what he has. And they would do what they could to take it. And so they delivered Jesus up because of envy. That is, the Jewish leaders of that day, the religious leaders of that day, saw all the attention that Jesus was getting, the crowds that he could draw. But they didn't get that kind of attention. Remember, that's what they wanted. They would have long prayers in the marketplace in order to draw attention to themselves. They would wear a certain kind of clothing in order to draw attention to themselves. And if they weren't getting the attention that they thought they deserved, then Jesus was. Their hearts were filled with envy. And that's why they delivered him up. They had ill will toward him because of that. And they were seeking to have what he had. That is the influence among the people that he had. Verse 18 of Matthew 27. For he knew that because of envy they had delivered him up. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him saying, now while he's sitting on the judgment seat, same term we find in other places as God's judgment seat or the judgment seat of Christ that will all appear before. He's seated on a judgment seat because he's rendering judgment. And so he's sitting there, and his wife sent to him. That is, she sent a note to him, or she sent word to him some way, saying, have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him. Have nothing to do with that just man. Just or righteous man. Word could be translated righteous. And Jesus is referred to as one who is just or righteous in many different places in the New Testament. He was just or righteous. He was innocent. He was just and righteous in that he kept all the commandments and ordinances of God, blameless. He was righteous before man and before God. He was just. He was innocent. There was no reason why he should be on trial. He had committed no crime. And the wife of Pilate sends this message to him, for I have suffered many things today. Suffered physically? No, perhaps emotionally. Now, we're not told in any certain way in the text here or the other gospel accounts as well whether this dream was brought about by the inspiration of God or influence of the Holy Spirit. She could have simply had it on her mind when she went to sleep and dreamed about this. Remember, and one would say, well, how would she have it on her mind? Well, Pilate evidently had authorized the use of Roman soldiers when they took Jesus into authority, remember? And since he had authorized that, and he knew that he was going to be standing trial during this particular period of time, and remember, he stands trial before Pilate, even perhaps before sunrise, because in John's account, it's the sixth hour, according to Roman time, at 6 o'clock in the morning when he renders the judgment. And then Mark tells us that he's crucified at the ninth hour in Jewish time. That would be 9 o'clock in the morning, or the third hour, excuse me. And so it's very early in the morning, and he's seated on the judgment seat. And his wife sends a note to him or sends word to him, have nothing to do with this just man, for I've suffered many things. I've suffered emotionally, no doubt, many things today in a dream because of him. So perhaps she went to bed with it on her mind, and then she dreamed about it. But the chief priest and the elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. Now, if you could picture what's going on here, they rendered judgments out in the open square. Now, this was near the dwelling place of the governor, on a pavement, it's called. One of the other gospel accounts refer to it as by some other term. Gabbatha is what it was, a pavement where the stone foundation where the judgment seat was seated, and the governor would come out and render judgment publicly and in the open. And so there would be multitudes of people gathered around. And can you imagine the chief priest and the elders of the people in the Sanhedrin council intermingling with the people in the crowds and trying to persuade them and encourage them to ask for Barabbas. Release Barabbas. Free Barabbas and destroy Jesus. Destroy him? Have him put to death. That's the idea in the word destroy there. Matthew 27, verse 20. Verse 21, the governor answered and said to them, which of the two do you want me to release to you? They said, Barabbas. Now think about this. Religious leaders who are trying to hold to the law of God, according to the law of Moses, oh, they're so pious, and they're so self-righteous, but yet they're willing to put an innocent man to death, an innocent and just man to death, and release a murderer, release one who has raised an insurrection, release a robber. They were willing to do that, and that's exactly what they wanted done. Verse 22 of Matthew 27, Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all said to him, "Let him be crucified." Let him be crucified. Crucifixion during this time period served three purposes. Crucifixion was a way and a means by which one could be publicly humiliated, shamed, reviled, and reproached. I want you to think about that. Even sometime in the history of our own nation, people were publicly humiliated, shamed, reviled, and reproached in different ways. Some of you remember in the founding of the nation, sometimes they would put stocks up out in the public square and put your hands through the holes in the stocks or your feet and hold you there. That way the public could walk by and revile and reproach. Public shaming and humiliation. That's one of the purposes that crucifixion served. A public humiliation. Lifted up on a cross so all could see. Spit upon you, revile you, reproach you, show contempt for you. Great way of public humiliation. A second thing that crucifixion served, a second purpose is that it served as a means of torture, because it was great torture that one underwent. One was physically tortured to death in the crucifixion itself. And that comes to the third purpose of crucifixion, and that is execution itself. So we're going to see those things in the crucifixion of Christ here. We're going to see the public humiliation that took place, the public shame, reproaching and reviling by the public in general as they would walk by the place of crucifixion and see him. One would think twice, wouldn't he, about claiming to be the Christ, claiming to be a king? If you do that, this is what's going to happen to you. One would think twice when they see the torture that's involved in crucifixion and then ultimately the execution, the putting one to death on the cross. So all of those things we're going to see. Matthew 27, and in verse 24, when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all. Now, it'd be good if you could go and read the other gospel accounts, Mark and Luke and John, because they add things to this. This was not a short trial in front of Pilate. Pilate did all he could to release Jesus. As a matter of fact, when he first found out he was Galilean, remember, he sent him to Herod, hoping that perhaps Herod would take care of it and Pilate wouldn't have to dirty his hands with it. But of course, Herod sent him back to Pilate. And so Pilate has to deal with it. But Pilate does everything he can to try to persuade the people that Jesus is innocent, that he's just, that he's committed no crime worthy of death. But because Pilate is in the position that he's in, and he's there for the purpose of keeping the Jews under control. Remember, Pilate is over the Judean province, and that province, of course, is under the oversight of the emperor himself. Tiberius put Pilate there for the purpose of keeping the Jews under control. And so he has to appease them. He has to appease them if You know, there's already been others who's caused insurrection. He doesn't want for riots to break out and the clamor of the people hollering for the death of Jesus. And so he's going to have him put to death. Verse 24, when Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was raising, a tumult, loud noise, a clamor, a riot perhaps breaking out, or would break out. But rather that a tumult was raising, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude. It was a symbolic act of showing that I'm washing my hands of this. Actually, the washing of his hands was showing himself, as the next phrase indicates, that he was innocent in this matter. That is, that he would have nothing to do, that is, no blood would be on his hands. The taking of the life of this innocent and just man is not his doing, but their doing. And that's brought out in the next phrase, in the next verse. He took water, washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. I'm innocent of the blood of this just person. Remember, the word blood here is put for taking the life of this just person. I'm innocent of taking the life of this just person. That's what they want to do. So he says, you see to it. That's the same thing that the chief priest and some of the Sanhedrin council had told Judas, remember, when he brought 30 pieces of silver back? What is that to us? We don't care. You see to it. You bear responsibility for it. It's not on us, it's on you. You're the one that delivered him up for 30 pieces of silver. You see to it. And so he went out and hanged himself. So Pilate tells them, you see to it. You take care of it. You bear responsibility for the shedding of innocent blood here. And so they accepted the responsibility, as the next verse indicates. And all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. His blood be on us and on our children. Good point. Because that's when God carried out his wrath on them for shedding the innocent blood of all the saints and prophets and even his son that he would send to them. Remember in the Old Testament prophets, he would rise up early and send them prophets. Rise up early and send. That is, he would do it over and over again. What would they do? They'd put him to death. Eventually they put his son to death. And he carried out judgment upon them by the Romans in 70 AD when they destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Now, in connection with this, there's been some people in the world who say that the Jews put Jesus to death, and they have condemned all Jews for that. But that's not true according to the Scripture. Those who had put Jesus to death were those who were present on this occasion. Just as our sons are not responsible for our crimes or our offenses, neither were their children going to be. They were going to be held responsible for it. They put Christ to death, they would be held accountable for it. And within 40 years, that generation did and was held accountable and responsible for it. So not the nation as a whole, the Jews as a whole, they were not guilty of putting Jesus to death. But yet many people hold the Jews as a people guilty of putting Jesus to death. But it's only those people who were responsible for it. And as Brother Justice mentioned, God executed justice on them in 70 AD by the Romans. Verse 26, Matthew 27, then he released Barabbas to them. And when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. When he scourged Jesus. when he scourged Jesus. Now, scourging during this particular period of time by the Romans was not what just what we might refer to as a whip, but it was a special kind of whip, actually referred to as a scourge itself. It was a whip with several straps of leather, and in the end of those straps of leather would be either broken pieces of bone or metal inserted into the end of those straps. And that way, when that leather strap would hit the back or the chest of one, and then it was pulled away, then the flesh would be ripped away. Now I want you to think about that. He was scourged. Many people didn't even live through this scourging. We wonder why it was, perhaps, that he couldn't carry his cross. They had to get someone to carry his cross. Well, because he'd been scourged. Pilate is not innocent in this. Even though he symbolically washes his hands and says, "I'm innocent of the blood." No, he has a part in this too. If he was an upright man himself, if he was a man of any integrity at all, he would have stood the ground and said, "He's an innocent man, I set him free." But of course, all of this is in harmony with God's will. God had planned this, that Jesus was going to die for the sins of mankind, and that's what's happening here. Even though it's all committed in a very unlawful and ungodly way, through lies, deception, deceit, and then putting an innocent man to death. Verse 27 of Matthew 27, "Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison around him." They took Jesus into the praetorium. The praetorium here would be perhaps the place where the Roman soldiers, actually this is the governor's residence where they're at, but this place where the soldiers would, there would be a group of soldiers that was assigned to the protection of the governor, and they would reside at his residence in a separate hall, of course, and that's the praetorium that is under consideration. Much like even with our president today, there's Secret Service officers that reside at the residence where he resides, not in the same room and not in the same part of the building, but they reside there for his protection. And so it was for the governor. There were Roman soldiers there to provide his protection. But we get an idea of the size and the capacity of this praetorium and how many soldiers was involved by the word garrison here. "Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole garrison or cohort around him." Gathered the whole garrison or cohort around him. So Jesus is here in the middle of this praetorium, in the middle of this, we'll call it a barracks, where the soldiers resided, and all of them have gathered around him. It says the whole garrison, the whole cohort. We talked about a legion, a Roman legion, a week or so ago. Remember, during this particular period of time, historians tell us that there could have been anywhere from 6,000 to 7,000 Roman soldiers in a legion. Well, a cohort or a garrison was 600 or 700. There were 10 cohorts in a legion. And so we're talking about a sizable force, a sizable group of Roman soldiers. So the whole garrison has gathered around him. Now, everything that takes place in the verses to follow here is for the purpose of mocking and ridiculing Jesus. He has claimed to be the Christ, the Messiah. He affirmed the answer to the question that Pilate had asked him earlier, "Are you a king?" He said, "Yes, I am." And so the things that the Roman soldiers are going to do to him are all mocking him in regard to him being the Christ, him being the Messiah, him being the King. Verse 28. And they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. Put a scarlet robe on him? Crimson would be the color that's under consideration here. I think John uses the word purple. So we see the closeness, perhaps, of the colors, because one says purple and the other says scarlet or crimson. But it's the royal colors that are under consideration. The robe that is mentioned here perhaps came from a high Roman official, a high Roman soldier, an officer perhaps. And so they dress him in the scarlet or purple robe because he claims to be royalty. He claims to be a king. So they're mocking him in that way. They're showing contempt for him, ridiculing him by dressing him in this robe. Now note this, they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. They stripped him. In the other gospel accounts, of course, they take his clothes, plural, off. And when they take the robe off, they put his clothes, plural, back on him. That is, they take his outer garment off and his inner garment, and they put the scarlet robe on him. To take his clothes off was to humiliate him. That was part of the public humiliation, to shame one in his nakedness. And so they put this scarlet robe on him to mock him because he claims to be a king. Verse 29 of Matthew 27. And when they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head. They put it on his head. I imagine they just didn't place it up there real easily. They perhaps forced it down on his head. The crown, twisted crown of thorns. We know what thorns are. A twisted crown. The word translated crown here, remember there's different crowns in the New Testament. The crown here is the Stephanos. It's the victor's crown. But emperors also wore it, kings. And so they're putting a crown on him because he claims to be a king. They're crowning him. But I thought it's something because it's not the royal diadem that they put on his head. But they put the victor's crown because he is the victor. He might not appear to be the victor, but he is the victor in this case. Verse 29, Matthew 27, and when they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head and a reed in his right hand, not his left hand, a reed. Now, what comes to our mind when we think of a reed is perhaps a reed, out on the banks of the Jordan, perhaps blowing and waving back and forth in the breeze. But the reed under consideration was a measuring reed or a measuring rod. It was something of substantial weight. It was something that could be used as a measuring rod. They put a reed in his right hand. Somebody tell me what's the symbolism there? It
power.
Power and authority. The reed in his right hand symbolizes the king or the emperor's scepter in his right hand. The right hand is the hand of power. So they put the reed in his hand. Later on, they're going to take the reed out of his hand and hit him over the head with it, which tells us that it's not just a flimsy piece of grass. It's something that could actually do harm to one. So they put the reed in his right hand to symbolize the fact that he is a king. It's his scepter. Again, they're mocking him. And they bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." They bowed the knee before him as if he is royalty. "Hail, King of the Jews." The word "hail" there, we might, in the English language, we might say, "Long live the King." Again, they're mocking and ridiculing him. He doesn't look much like a king the way they've got him made up. But they're doing all of this to mock and ridicule him. Verse 30, then they spat on him and took the reed and struck him on the head. They spat on him. Remember, we have talked about that before. They spat on him. That was expected during that particular period of time. It was a way to shame one publicly. As a matter of fact, you go back in the Old Testament and read, I forget where it's at, someplace in Deuteronomy, I believe, where if a brother would not marry his brother's wife, the first brother had died, and she needs to be married in order to be able to bring up children to carry the family name on. If that second brother wouldn't marry that widow, then she was to bring him into the marketplace publicly and spit in his face to show him to be shamed before the people. So to spit in one's face was to simply show that one was disapproved of and was ashamed and shamed in the eyes of the people. So they were doing that to him at this time, and they took the reed and struck him on the head. They hit him over the head with his own power. They hit him over the head with his own authority. The reed again represented his scepter. All right, we're out of time. Questions or comments? We'll pick up then at verse 31, Matthew 27, next Wednesday evening. Thank you very much for your kind attention.